These, in these interviews, I like to start in with the player's early years, family, back on what the parents did and how they got into baseball in school and professional. And so could you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and family background?
That's where you want to start?
Yeah.
Well,
it's going now.
Now?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I was raised in Mishawaka, Indiana. I played, started there playing semi-pro ball. Then I had a call from Muskegon, Michigan in the Central League. That's a Class B league. And asked me if I would come up. So I thought it was a chance. So I got the next train and paid my way to Muskegon, got off the train, got in a taxi, and they were playing an afternoon game. I took the taxi to the ballpark, paid the taxi, paid my way into the ballpark, reported down in the dugout. The game was going along about the third or fourth inning then when I got there.
What year would this be?
This was 1920. 1920. And I never asked to get all that, not all, it wasn't much, but I didn't ask to get the money back. I just was happy to get an opportunity. So I stayed there in 1920 and 21, and I was sold then to Indianapolis.
Who was the manager at Muskegon?
Doc White.
Doc
he
White.
Was an old White Sox pitcher, left-handed pitcher. Then I was sold to Indianapolis for $3,900, outfielder and myself, both of us, for $3,900.
Who was the outfielder?
I don't remember his name. He didn't stay there, no. So,
well, tell me about these early years now in Mishawaka. Did your dad play ball?
Oh, yeah, my dad played factory league ball. They had those towns around there, they all had factory leagues, and he loved baseball, and he played, and he was a pretty good ball player, but never a professional, and so he thought it was a good chance for me, so I went up there.
Did you go to high school, Mishawaka?
Yes, I went to high school.
Did they have a team?
Well, I was too busy with these semi-pro teams and factory teams, you see, as soon as I was first year of high school, they were after me to play with them, you see, and then I had to work out and train with them, so I didn't have too much time. I didn't go out for football. Newt Rockne was a football coach at Notre Dame, and he was after me to come to Notre Dame, which was only 4 miles away, and I didn't want to. I didn't want any part of football. I wanted baseball. So, as I was saying, that this...
How'd you do up at Muskegon? Remember how you did there?
Oh, my record, I don't remember. I got around here somewhere, but it wasn't too bad. And so I went to Indianapolis.
And who was coach or manager down there?
Jack Hendricks.
How'd you like Jack Hendricks?
Well, he was a odd sort of a person. He wasn't bad. He was a good baseball man. He went from Indianapolis to Cincinnati and managed Cincinnati. And he was a good baseball man. And then Donnie Bush replaced him. And Donnie was the manager. Donnie Bush was the manager when they sold me to the Giants. They sold me for $50,000 to the Giants. And they paid $3,900 for two of us. So it was a pretty good profit.
You didn't get any percentage of
No. Well, just happy. So I reported the Cincinnati and the Giants were on the road.
Well, you played 23 and 24 in Indianapolis, or how many years?
Yeah.
Those 2 years.
Yeah, I was sold in 25.
Middle of the season or early?
Yeah, in August in 25 to the Giants.
How did the Giants, who signed you for the Giants, or who scouted you, or how did
I don't know who the scout was. I just really don't know who the scout was that recommended me, but I know that when I went there, I started as a starter the last half of the season in 25. I wound up winning six and three.
74 innings.
Yeah, and so from then on, I was a starting pitcher for the rest of my life, you see.
What was your first meeting with John McGraw like?
A little scary. Yeah, he was a tough hombre. But I'm telling you, he was a marvelous man. I enjoyed playing for him as long as I did.
Well, were they in pitching trouble when you came up? I mean, they just won a couple of pennants before then.
Yeah, I thought it was dandy that I was going to join a ball club that had won four pennants, I think, in a row. And, they were looking for help in their pitching.
Who'd they have on the staff?
Well, I don't know. Kent Greenfield and Jack Scott and Virgil Barnes and Art Neff.
Oh, yeah.
And, but they were looking for a right-hand pitcher, you see.
As soon as you came up, they didn't win any more pennants, did they?
No, they didn't. I went to 1933 before we won, and that was under Bill Terry.
Yeah.
And then 1936 we won again.
I interviewed Kent Greenfield.
Yeah, you did talk to him?
Yeah.
He had the potentials of being a great pitcher, but something happened to the boy.
He said he had a drinking problem.
Oh, yeah.
He admitted
it.
Well,
I didn't want to say it, but he got so the latter part of his career, he had to carry a bottle with him.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He's shaking, though. He's over 70 now. Yeah. Doing pretty well there.
Good. He's raising dogs, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, it's too bad that a boy will, throw away those things and has a chance. Because he went to the Braves and he didn't stay there very long, and they released him.
Well, how about Ross Young? Is he with the team when you
came
up?
Yes, he was there, but not very long.
What happened to him?
He had this, I don't know what it was, a disease or gout and everything else with it. And he was a great seafood eater. Shrimp and lobster and any time of the day or night, you see. And they said that was caused a lot of his trouble. I know I was there, and I was there the year he died, and he was buried in San Antonio.
Was he playing that year, actually?
Yep. Yeah.
Played almost up to the time.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he played, and then he got so his feet would... legs swelled up so bad he couldn't play anymore. So
it wasn't that sudden then, or did?
Yeah, it came on him sudden. Yeah, he was a young fella.
Yeah, he wasn't even 30
yet. Yeah, he was a great hitter. He was a great fielder and a good runner.
Uh-huh.
So he had all the tools too.
Who was your left fielder? Was that Irish Musial?
Irish Musial, yeah. And then Billy Southworth was in the center field, and then he went someplace. I don't remember. And we had Bill Terry at first, and Freddie Lister at third, and Jackson at second base, yeah, and shortstop, and Frisch at second, and Frank Snyder, Hank Gowdy were the catchers. So they had a good hitting ball club.
Frisch was traded in 27, was he, for Hornsby? How did Hornsby fit in when he came over?
Well, I tell you, Hornsby, I played against him and I played under him, you see. And you don't like to say anything about a person. And
I understand, but he's gone.
Yeah, he's gone, and it doesn't help. It doesn't help anything, you see. But he wasn't too well liked.
Uh-huh.
See, he was he never drank. He didn't believe in eating meat too much.
Didn't associate with
And he wouldn't sleep in the room with the windows open or anything. He's afraid he gets in the cold or something. But I don't know.
He spent a lot of time at the racetrack.
Great ball player. It was wonderful.
I would think that with McGraw and Hornsby, there might have been a clash of temperaments.
There was. Because McGraw got sick one year, and after we got Hornsby, and couldn't make a road trip. So he put Hornsby in charge on this road trip. And Hornsby, I'll tell you, tried to change some rules. See, like no newspapers in the clubhouse. You couldn't smoke in the clubhouse. couldn't play cards in the clubhouse. See, that was, McGraw allowed all that. So it wasn't only about, well, those were 18, sometimes 18 and 20 day road trips that we made. And I think about half of it had been gone when here come McGraw. See, he just thought, you know, I heard something was wrong, probably from a newspaper man or something. And so, yeah, well, I don't know this.
Well, I was going to ask about 1928 was one of your best years.
Yeah.
20 games.
Yeah.
Remember much about that year?
Oh, no, I don't remember. I led the league, National League, in 1930. And, 1930, and then 10 years later, I led it again.
That was at 16-2 year.
16-2 with Brooklyn. Yes,
a real comeback.
39 or 40 years old.
What accounted for that?
Well, I had my arm operated on, a lot of bone chips, scar tissues and adhesions, and lime deposits in my elbow. I had it operated on in July, and in September I was pitching again. And so I just had to build it up. I had to learn to throw a little different.
That was in 39 you had the operations?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're really ready for 40 now.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was remarkable.
Yeah.
Well, when Terry took over in 32, is that right?
I don't know if it was 32, but we won the pennant in 33.
Yeah, how was it, this change of managers then? How did Terry, was his method different?
You could see that the game was played under practically the way McGraw taught everybody. See, Terry grew up under McGraw, too.
That's right.
But the discipline was so different, you see.
And, what respects?
Every ways, you know. See, these fellows that are playing today, they couldn't have played for McGraw. See, and I doubt whether McGraw could have managed these fellows today. I'll give you an idea. Now, we had a 12 o'clock rule at night. The trainer came by the door, and two in a room, and knocked on the door, and you didn't yell from the other side, "I'm here and my roommate's here." You had to open the door, or the trainer had to see both of you. See? All right. That at 12. And if you weren't in and out, you were fined. A pretty good hunk, $200. No whiskey drinking on the club. $250 fine if anybody was caught drinking even a small jigger of whiskey. 9 o'clock in the morning, you had to be in the restaurant, and we all signed our checks. And the trainer was sitting at the front door of the restaurant, checking everybody in. He had his sheet. He'd check in what time he got in, and if you're 9 o'clock, you weren't there, why, he just bust you off. Now you had to sign your checks, and we were allowed $4.50 a day to eat on. And you signed your checks, and you paid your tips out of your own pocket. And if you went 50 cents a dollar over your tab, they took it out of your check. Now these fellows get $27, I think, I'm not sure, $25 to $27 a day, meal money. Well, you know, a lot of those guys are making a pretty good hunk out
or
of
else
that.
Or they're overeating.
Yeah.
Let's see how we sound here, Warren.
Well, I was pretty fortunate. I mean, I had good legs and a good arm.
You ever have any arm trouble besides those bone chips late in the
game? No, I had a sore arm.
Seemed like you pitch a lot of innings every year here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I pitched
200 innings every year.
I pitched 19 years.
Uh-huh. 35, you dropped off to 94 innings. Was your problem that year, do you remember?
Yeah, that's when
this began to develop.
Just starting to draw up, you see. Uh-huh. Then 35, I had it operated on.
Uh-huh.
See, and then 36, I pitched in the World Series against the Yankees. That's when I had my arm operated in 1935. So that's when it was hurting me.
How'd you do in the World Series then? I don't remember.
Well, I pitched against Washington. I got shut out by Earl Whitehill. I allowed five hits. Got shut out. I pitched against the Yankees. I got the 2-1. I pitched a four-hitter. I pitched against the Yankees in Brooklyn, and I, eighth inning or seventh inning, I got my kneecap broke with a line drive, and the score was nothing to nothing. But my club had scored me one run in three ball games. See, and I allowed five and four and five. I allowed 14 hits in three ball games. But I never won one. It's just...
That was a great pitching staff in 33, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I talked to Roy Parmalee.
Oh, you did?
Up in
He's still around in Toledo?
Yeah, Monroe, Michigan. He's got
arthritis. I knew that. Is he still with the... Is he working?
He's retired now from
the
Automobile
Club or something. He was
a wild man.
Oh, so he could throw hard.
Yeah.
Throw awful
the
hard.
Batters stayed loose, didn't they?
Huh? Oh, yeah. Well, they just didn't step in too much. And Schumacher and Hubble and myself. Yeah, we were required.
Did you have any trouble with the wildness at all?
Me? Yeah. Oh, no. No.
You ever hit anybody?
Oh, yeah. I've hit them on purpose, too.
Oh, you have? I didn't think pitchers did that.
Oh, yeah. I had an example in Pittsburgh one day. Red Smith, he was a catcher with the Giants. Some way, McGraw hated him, didn't like him. So he traded him to Pittsburgh. Now, we're playing in Pittsburgh the next year, and I got a man on second base and a man on third base. And I got two men out. And Red Smith is a hitter. He's a left-hand hitter. He's a pretty good hitter. And so I was a knuckleball pitcher, see. He fouled two knuckleballs off on me. Got 2-0 on him, see. So when I got two strikes and no balls on him, McGraw was over on the bench, jumped up on the front row of the dugout and hollered at me. He said, "If this one is anywhere near that plate," he said, "it's going to cost you $500. He said, "I want to see this guy hit the dirt." See?
Smith hear this? Everybody hear this?
Huh?
Everybody could hear this?
Oh, yeah. The umpires, they have to just stand there. Well, I used to walk up right, within 6 feet of the hitter. So get ready, you're going down. And turn around and walk back. So when I finished this other, McGraw said, "Now you remember this." See? So he had a sign with the catcher, from the bench to the catcher. And the catcher kept looking in at him, and no signs. He just standing there, making a lot of neck red, the face red, but no knockdown sign. See? So the catcher finally, and Red Smith backed up out of the batter's box and stood there and looked at McGraw and stood there. And finally, he got back up in there, and the catcher went down and gave me a fastball sign. But no knockdown. See, that was our knockdown with a thumb. So he didn't give me that. He just gave me a fastball sign. So I wound up and I threw him right down the middle. And Smith had the bat up here, and he started back, and he started falling backwards on his heels, you see. And I soon called him third strike, and the game's over. So we had to go through the Pittsburgh dugouts, and you could get to the clubhouse in the old Pittsburgh park. And he stood there at the top of the deck of the dugout, and he said, "Well, my God," he said, "I wanted to give a nickel for my chances then." Well, I said, I just took a chance. See, he thought he was going to get knocked down with all McGraw talking. Yeah. See. So the game's over. So McGraw runs off of the bench, runs out, and I'm just walking off. He runs out to the mound. He said, "Say, Sonny," he said, "listen to me." He said, "I'll strike those hitters out for you."
Well, he was just really intimidating Smith.
Well, yeah, he's getting him,
making him to think twice and back away.
Yeah, if he'd have meant it, you see, he'd have given whatever sign he used with the catcher, his fist or whatever it was, to knock him down.
But
twice.
Giving no sign.
No sign.
You just knew you meant
so the hitter, so the catcher was smart enough. He just gave me a fastball sign, and then I don't say I was smart enough. But I just wound up and I said, "Well, hell, I didn't see a knockdown pitch, so I'm just going to grab back and throw it as hard as I can right down the middle. See if he takes it." And he did. And everybody's telling me, "Would you rather be playing now than then?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "Of course, I'd have made a lot more money than I make now." See, I held out 1 year. Stolen. That's the year I won the pennant. Not won the pennant, but led the National.
30?
No, in 28 when I had
20
years. And I held out. And McGraw made me hold out. See, he was the vice president of the ball club, and he called me in the office after the season was over, the last game, and said, "Now," he said, "I'll tell you something. I want you to get a raise now." I said, "Don't you sign. So they do." So McGraw goes to Cuba every winter and doesn't report to San Antonio until the regulars get there, the catchers and outfielders and infielders. But the pitchers are there about 10 days so they can get ready to pitch batting practice, time everybody else gets ready and start the ball games, you see. So McGraw comes when the regulars come. And I'm 2 weeks late, and they issued an order out of New York. It was $100 a day fine. But anybody holding out didn't report, and I'm $1,400 behind, see, in fines. So McGraw got into San Antonio, he saw I wasn't there. He called me. He said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "You know what's the matter. You told me to stay here if I didn't get a raise." And they wouldn't give me a raise. And he said, "Well," he said, "you just hang on now." He said, "You get on the first plane you can. Come on down here." So I got on the plane. When I got down there, he had me all straightened around, a little fine. And
you got the raise?
Yeah, I got a little raise, yeah. I think I got a $2,500 raise. Now, if you'd win that, now you'd ask for $40,000 or $50,000 raise.
Mm-hmm. Eddie Rausch was with you a few years ago.
Yeah, he was with Cincinnati, and then he came over to the Giants. He didn't stay there very long.
He liked to hold out, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, he didn't believe in spring training. That's the only thing about him. It wasn't the holding out that meant anything. He didn't believe in going to spring training and using all that. He said he could get right out of bed and go to hit.
He may have been right.
Oh, yeah. And that's the way he was. He wouldn't report. He didn't give it. He was a stubborn Indian. He was smart Indian, I think.
I had a real good interview with him over in Oakland City.
You know. Yeah. Yeah, Oakland City. He's quite a fisherman. He was a dandy.
How about Mel Lott? Were you with the Giants when he broke in?
I was there when he came up.
That's about the same year as you, wasn't
he? No, he came after me.
Oh, yeah. Right.
About a year or two after me. We got him right out of high school. He came up as a catcher. And he was short, you know, and McGraw says, you just take that catcher's glove, and I was right there when they were talking. He said, "Take that catcher's glove and throw it right out that window." He said, "You're not going to put it on anymore. Get you a fielder's glove, an outfielder's glove. You're going to be an outfielder from now on." Well, the first year he did nothing but pinch hit for us. He had 365 pinch hit. Next year he's playing regular.
Did he replace Youngs?
Huh?
Did he replace Youngs, maybe?
Yeah. He went to right field. Yeah.
Just about Youngs at the time Youngs
came? Yeah. He replaced Youngs. See, and Ott had to go back to high school to finish.
Was that right?
Yeah, he had to go back to Gretna, Louisiana, to finish high school.
How old was he then?
About 16. Exactly.
How did the players treat a kid
great,
that young?
Great. Wonderful.
Didn't give him a hard time?
Oh, no. Well, the only thing that young fellows get treated bad is when they come up and say, spring training, and they start to crowd themselves into batting practice.
Yeah.
See, they say, get out of there. We'll tell you what you can hit. See, so they kind of control them, which is right, you see. And have a fresh kid come up and say, well.
I guess it wasn't fresh, was it?
Oh, he wouldn't open his mouth. He wouldn't open his mouth. He just did everything, and everybody helped him, you see, because he was quiet. But if he got a little fresh, they put you in their place, which was right.
Did you have any problems when you came up with this kind of situation?
No. The only thing they said when I joined the club in Cincinnati, I went into the sitting hotel when I reported. They were sitting in the lobby, most of them, waiting to go out to the ballpark, and they saw me come in. And two or three of them told me this afterwards. They said, look at that, there comes a good beer drinker. See, and I didn't drink, I didn't drink or smoke or anything, you see. All the time I was in the big leagues, I didn't drink. See. And so I think that was a lot to do with my conditioning and everything else, you see. And I worked hard.
You ever have trouble getting in shape at all?
No.
You stay in shape in the off season?
Yeah.
What'd you do, hunt or?
I just walked and did some road work and watched my diet. Mm-hmm. We trained in Los Angeles in 1930. McGraw was the manager then. And I thought, well, I'm going to be in real good shape. I'm going to report down to in spring training about 198 pounds. So I walked in that clubhouse and he was there and he looked at me and he said, come here, I want to talk to you. I said, so quick? And he said, yes, I want to talk to you. I said, what about? Well, sir, he said, don't ever let me see you coming into spring training anymore under 215. Said, you can't stand it. And he was about right, you see. But I went on then and I got back. I pitched, my last 10, 12, 15 years was 215 or more, see.
Did you really feel it when you were a little lighter that year? I mean, did you have a...
Yeah, but he made me come right back up. He wouldn't let me stay there.
Yeah.
So I got right back up there. And I lose 14, 13 pounds a day pitching.
In St. Louis.
or in New York. I pitched against Chicago one day. Paul Florence was my catcher. And Hack Wilson was an outfielder for the Cubs. In the seventh inning, they both passed out in the heat.
Exactly.
And we were playing a doubleheader, and I pitched the first one. And lucky I won it. And so I spent the rest of the second game under the shower, just sitting on a stool. But I'd lost 14 pounds.
Wouldn't the ball be hard to grip in that kind of
thing? No, I used a lot of rosin. And I could put the rosin on my pants. You see, I rub the pants and I could rub the ball on the pants. You couldn't do any of that now, you see. But my hand would just be black after the game. Just black from my rosin.
Where'd you develop the knuckleball?
Oh, I did that when I was in high school. Kids.
Just out of your own?
Oh, yeah. Well, a fella that was playing used to play catch with me, throw a knuckleball, but it floated, you know, like these that they throw now. No speed, but floated. And I asked him, I said, how do you hold that? Well, he held it with these two knuckles and this. See, so I added, he had three fingers and these two, that finger and thumb.
The three first knuckles
were downward, you see. So I started it, so I said, I'm going to do a little different. I'm going to use these two, and I'm going to do the gripping with these two and the thumb. see, like that. See, so well, I threw it almost as fast as my fastball. And I knew where it was going to break all the time. See, I could break it down away from a right-hander. I could break it down away from a left-hander, you see. But no control. I could throw it 3-2, 3-1, and if I had to, I'd throw it in the World Series to Red Ruffing, who pinched it. 3-0.
And you had that much confidence in that?
Well, you know, I had to have, you see. That was my good out pitch, and I could control it. So this Red Ruffing, he took picks on, you see. He had 3-0. So he's going to hit this fat one, you see. So I just said, well, it's going to... I'm pretty sure I can get it over. So he hit it, man on third base. And he hit a little dribbler down off of my right, and I picked it up and threw the man out of the plate, you see. It would have been a fastball, and he might have ripped it, you see. But this... The big thing in my pitching, I was not a Sandy Koufax or one of these other guys that this Ryan down there that right back and fired the ball and overpowered him. See, I had to pitch to spots, and I had exceptionally good control, and I knew just about. I studied hitters. That was my best thing that I did. I studied hitters.
During the game here on the
yes,
bench?
Yes, I watched other pitchers pitch against them, and I studied them, you see.
You can remember these things?
Oh, yeah, you had to with Under McGraw. Because he had a meeting every day, and his pitching staff, and he let the pitcher who was going to pitch today go over the whole lineup, tell you how you're going to pitch. He didn't tell you you're going to pitch him so-and-so. So you told him what you were going to do, and he already told me to pitch high, inside and outside. And so when it was my turn to pitch, and he said, no, I want you to tell these outfielders and infielders where you're going to pitch. And so I went down right over the lineup, and he remembers all these things.
You could pitch the knuckle. You call your own knuckleball pitch, really, then. Catcher or the bench wouldn't.
Oh, no.
My
catcher.
Like
only
you.
Once in a while, McGraw would get a hunch. You see, he wanted a certain pitch. He had a sign with the catcher, but not too often. Once in a while.
If you wanted to throw that knuckler, you called it.
Oh, yeah. The catcher, if he went down for a fastball, and I didn't want to throw it. See, I didn't ever shake my head. I just looked him off. So the hitter, you know, if he saw me shake my head, he'd say, oh, I'm not getting a fastball, I'm getting a knuckleball, see. So I looked him off, and he didn't know whether I'm changing the sign or what, you see.
And then the catcher would usually call the knuckler.
Oh, yeah, he switched. As soon as he saw me stare, not like this, but as soon as I didn't take it and back up or start to wind up, he knew I wanted something else, you see.
What did they think about up in Muskegon when you came with this knuckler up there? Did that?
Well, Josh DeVore, do you remember him?
Oh, yeah. He came from our community.
Yeah. He was a manager of Grand Rapids. He was the first team I pitched against. And he ran out of that dugout, I'd say at least 15 times during the ball game, telling the umpire, let me look at the ball. He said, "That you can't tell me." He said, "I've been around too long. That guy's throwing spitters." See, and the umpire would take the ball and he'd go over and he'd hand it to Josh. He said, "Look at it, brother. He's throwing spitters." And I'd go back and I'd wind up and throw another one. That's what they called it, a dry spitter.
Oh, I see.
Broke the same way, But catcher didn't have any trouble catching me. He didn't have these big gloves and slap it with one hand. He knew where the ball was going to break, see. And Mancuso, my catcher, was the best catcher that I ever pitched to. He could read my mind.
He knew
exactly what I didn't have to shake him off much. He knew, see. Now, to give you another, this Mickey Owens, we got from the Cardinals. See, he was caught and... He caught me over there in Brooklyn. Well, I never spent so much. All I saw was three fingers. Knuckleball. Never a fastball, never a curve, never a changeup. Knuckleball. Every time he have a pitch he called. So I just had to back off the rubber and I get him out there. I said, you only got three fingers on your hand, or are they taped together? Yeah. he was a hard hit catcher.
Well, when you went to McGraw, then, did he like the knuckleball, or?
Oh, yeah. Didn't bother. Only thing he did to me when I joined the club, I was about a three-quarters turn. See, when I wound up, and then I turned, I was this way. He said, now, Fred, he said, you're this way. Why not go all the way around? So he made me wind up, and when I finished up, or when I turned around, I was facing center field, second base. He came around. He said, the reason for that is the hitter doesn't look to see where you got your hat on, straight or not, or anything like that. They're watching that ball. Now, he said, when you come around and this club comes out in front of it, they got to pick it up. See? And that's true. See, when I hide it, and went, they saw nothing but my back. Now they've lost sight of the ball. They don't know whether I come this way, or underhand, you see. And the glove out in front of the ball, now they had to pick it up here.
So that was just a little bigger turn.
A little extra turn. And all that was, of course, I had to do a lot of more concentration. Because they tell pitchers nowadays, the young pitchers, don't take your eye off of the plate. See, keep your eye on the plate. Well, I never did, so I could never. And I was a pitching coach, and I never could tell any of my young pitchers, don't do that. And they'd say, well, you didn't do it. See, and but it's concentration. My only training to them would be, when you're a child, and you start to walk up a stairs, your mind up here tells this foot, step up to this step. Then your mind tells your foot, step up there. So you do that enough that now your mind don't have to bother with these legs. They automatically do it. Now you say to the ball, when you turn and when you throw, fastball, curve, I don't care what you throw. When you, before you release it, you say to your arm, I want this ball low. I want it high. I want it inside. I want it outside. That's where it's going to go the majority of the time. But there's a lot of these young pitchers that's one of Ryan's trouble. That was Koufax's trouble. Right back in, when the ball went out of the hand, it was on their own. See, they didn't know. They didn't say, throw it high, throw it low. They just throw it hard, see. And it took Koufax, he was 9 years in the big leagues before he won 10 or 12 games, I think. And Ryan, he's walks 15, 12, and geez, it's a...
Who was pitching when Owen dropped that third strike?
Casey Stengel.
Who was pitching?
Yeah.
No, the
not Casey Stengel.
Hugh Casey.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, that must have been a blow to the...
Oh, yeah, team. Yeah. And the pictures, the movies that they showed Owens with his glove here, and the ball's a strike. Mm-hmm. But his head and eyes is straight ahead, and his glove's down there. He never has seen the ball here because he's looking out straight ahead. It was a third strike. And the ball went through his legs.
Was he not a very good catcher?
He had a good arm, and he was a good hustler. But he wasn't, to me, he wasn't a good catcher. I hate to say that about anybody, but he was a good hustler and a good, real good arm, throwing arm.
I think the Dodgers might have won that series if that out had been made.
Oh, yeah.
Won the game.
No question about it, yeah. No question about it. Yeah.
How was it to play for Leo?
Well, started off, Leo was fine, see. He was with Brooklyn and was the shortstop.
I keep looking here to make sure the tape doesn't run out. Yeah. I can't always be sure.
He was a shortstop, and he replaced Burley Grimes, see. And he said, Fred, now he said, I want you to handle my pitchers. I want you to coach at first base only when you're not pitching. So I'm still a starting pitcher, and I coached 3 days or 4 days at first base, you see. And then I hit fungus to the other pitchers and ran them because he knew I would keep in shape some way. He wouldn't have to bother with me. And went along fine. And then he went over to the Giants, and I went to the Braves with Southworth, and we won the pennant there and played in the World Series in 1948 against Cleveland. And so that year, Grosher went to the Giants. Now he's going to pitch, he's going to change his coaching staff all around, you see. So after the end of the year, he asked me if I would be interested in coming over to the Giants with him. I said, hell yes, I'll go with you. So I went to the Giants, and I was a pitching coach, and Herman Franks was the, and Frankie Frisch was the coach, and then he went to the Cubs as a manager, you see. And we got along fine. He put out a lineup on his desk, and I made out the lineup cards, even signed his name to the lineup cards. And Franks and I would take the club out and hitting practice and infield work and everything. He sometimes didn't get there until just 20 minutes or so before game time. But he had nothing to worry about. Everything was taken care of, you see.
A good staff.
Yeah, he had nothing. He knew that everything was fine, see. And then when it comes down to it, he wanted to change pitchers. He never went out to the pitcher. I went out to the pitchers. And took him out or talked to him or quiet him down or something. And then he went to the Cubs, and I'd been out about 10 years. 60, yeah. This was about six or seven years, I don't know. Anyway, he called me one day and asked me if I'd go to the Cubs with him. This was in 65, I think. He was manager of the Cubs, you see. But it was altogether different there. Yeah, I never saw a fellow like him. It changed overnight from the guy I knew, you see. And I just couldn't take it. And another thing was bad for me. I was 65 years old, and they played all-day games. And you're out there in that heat of the sun and all, and then you go on the road, play at night.
But playing for him back under Brooklyn, he was a good manager.
So he knew he was a gambler. Yeah. You know what I mean? A gambler. He'd hit and run, he'd squeeze bunt, he'd double steal, anything that he could do to win. But he had the material to do it. You see, he had Pee Wee, Reaser, and Reese, and he had Ducky Medwick, Dixie Walker.
Third baseman.
They had Cookie Lavachetto, and they had Pete Coscarat was the second baseman. And then Billy Herman came from the Cubs. So we had a ball club that could do a lot of things. They could steal signs if they got on second base. They got the catcher's sign, give it to you right now.
He knew how to really handle and manipulate all this talent.
Yeah, but he had the talent to do it. Yeah. You see,
it's easy to manage, really.
You
didn't quite have the talent. You were the Phillies, did you?
Oh, gee.
But how about your trade in '37 to Brooklyn? Did that bother you at all?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. See, I'd been there so long with the Giants, I thought I was part of the organization, you see. Generally, when you're there as long as I am, they find a spot for you, see. And so it hurt me pretty bad. But now I'm going to a club that's nothing. Yeah. Nothing but...
How did you find out about that club?
They called me up after... Here's the way it happened. Terry was the manager. Yeah. We're playing a game, and we got rained out. So I generally, being the oldest guy on the club, and I went in and asked him when this game would be made up. So he told me, and I went back out and I told the clubhouse boy to tell everybody that this game would be played as a part of a doubleheader, see. And that was the end of it. I went home, everybody went home. I, in the morning, got home 10 minutes, and he called me and said, "Well, we just traded to the Brooklyn. Where do you want your stuff sent?" I said, "I don't care, send it anywhere." But I mean, it was a cold-blooded thing. I mean, he could have been, he knew when I went in there, see, that I traded, see, he had traded me. So the way it turned out, it was a pretty good deal.
Yeah, you went to sure. Building team.
Yeah.
Who was in the deal again?
No, just me and Cash. They gave me and Cash for this other young pitcher.
Who was, who ran Brooklyn then?
Bertie Grimes.
I mean the owner.
Oh, he was
McKeever or?
Huh?
McKeever or?
No.
Wasn't Larry
McPhail. McPhail, yeah.
He wanted to.
Yeah. Oh, he was a dandy. Larry McPhail.
He knew how to put teams together.
Yeah.
You spoke about brushback pitches. You throw up their heads, do you, or just at their chin, or what do you throw? Do you knock them down?
I don't care. Right up the shoulder, right in there.
And you can always be pretty sure it's going to go in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, on the Kai Kai Kyler story when the tape ran out.
Well, this was Kyler. He was an inside hitter, right field hitter. I mean, an outside hitter. He hit the right field and right center. Good hitter. So you had to pitch him inside on his fist. So just one day I happened to get the ball a little too far inside and hit him in the side. And he dropped his bat and started out after me at the mound. So I started off on the mound after him. And then he turned before he got to me and went to first base. And on his way to first base, I said to him, "I wasn't throwing at you then. But remember this, the next time up, I'm going to knock you down real good. Now just remember, so be ready." So the next time up, the first two pitches I made to him, down he went. Both times. His hat flew off, the bat flew out of his hand. I didn't hit him, but it scared him a little bit, and he never even batted an eye or said a word to me. So on the next day, when we were coming out through his clubhouse, the dugout, to the Giants bench, he called me over. He said, "I'm sorry I said anything." I said, "So am I." I said, "Those things happen." So I said, "Forget it. That's the way it happens." I said, "I was telling you the truth. I didn't throw to hit you." And then I had another guy, Hack Wilson. He was a hit the ball, I don't care, any place. Bad, indifferent, or anything. He'd hit it. See? So I had two strikes on him one day in Chicago. And I thought, well, I'll brush him back a little bit. Well, I got the ball up here, just over his head, a little, not far enough inside. He took his bat like this and hit a home run in the right field off me. But those things, you see.
You mentioned Medwick did something.
Oh, Medwick is another guy. His first year up, he was a fresh ball player, bush, but a good one, a real good one. Hitter, throw, he did everything good. So I'm playing St. Louis in the Polo Grounds. And so the count got to 1-1, and I threw one up under his chin. And then the next one, I threw him a knuckleball, and he popped it up to second base. So going down to first base, he run down to first base, and coming down in place of going back out, you know, on the foul territory, he run across the fair territory in the infield. And he said to me, he said, when he got opposite the mound, he said, why don't you go warm up? So I didn't say anything to him. I just, I mean, Kusa was my catcher. He said, he didn't say anything. So the next time up, Medwick's up, see, I got him out on a ground ball to Terry. And I covered the bag, and he would run down there. And he said something else fresh to me, see. He said, you haven't got enough to hurt anybody. Well, I said, next time up, if I'm out here, I said, let's find out. So third time up, Mancuso's just didn't give me a sign. He was standing up. He was waiting for him to walk in the batter's box. And Mancuso was standing up. He wasn't squatted down. He yelled out, and he said, here he is. What do you want to do about it? I said, you just get down and do what you think I should do. And I'm leaving the thing up to him. So I went down the first. He gave me the thumb and down. I threw one right up here. His hat back flew and his bat flew. And he got dirt all over his uniform. We let him get up and brushed off. And his hat fixed back on his head and his bat in his hand. He got back up again and just didn't say a word. He just went down and gave me another one. See, down he went again, see. He never opened his mouth, see. I got him out 4-for-0 that day. So the next day, I thought, well, now I'm going to be working out at shortstop. They had the center field, you know, the Giants, polo grounds, center field, both clubhouses out there. So they had to come, for their hitting practice, they had to come right down behind my shortstop, see, walking. So I got my position over there during our hitting practice. I was going to be an infielder, see. But I was waiting for him. So here he come, and he walked right up beside of me. I didn't know whether he was going to take a pop at me or what. And he went up and put his hand on my shoulder. He said, I just want to apologize to you. He said, I don't blame you. He said, I shouldn't have opened my big mouth or popped off to you. Well, I said, now, I'm awful glad that you came by here and said this, because if you hadn't, those other pretty fastball pitchers like Plumlee and some of these other guys are going to throw at you, and one of them's going to hurt you. They won't mean to, but they'll hurt you, because they'll make a mistake. And he said, well, I just had to tell you. I said, well, that's good enough. No more. The rest of his, all his time he played against me, he never opened his mouth, and I knocked him down a couple of times during the course of the different years.
And your teammates?
Huh?
He became teammates.
Yeah, then he came over to Brooklyn. He was over there. Buddy, buddy.
How'd you like pitching in Baker Bowl?
Well, I pitched quite a few ball games there. There's quite a few ball games.
Have to pitch
there.
Differently there?
Oh, you had to. You just had to be careful a little bit more there than any other ballpark, see, because that right field fence was just ridiculous. But I pitched a series there one day. I started the first game of a 4-game series, and Jennings was a manager in place of McGraw. McGraw was in the hotel, he was sick. So Jennings was running the ball club. So I pitched the first game, beat him. So we got down to the 4 games, and two days rest, and he had nobody to pitch the fourth. We had a big left-hander come up sick. He always did when we played.
Who was that?
Oh, this big first baseman they used to have at pitch.
Bentley?
No. Yeah, Jack Bentley. Yeah. So every time he was supposed to pitch in the Philadelphia ballpark, he got sick. See. So Jennings came to me in the clubhouse. He said, Fred, he said, I got nobody to pitch this fourth game. He says, you only have 2 days rest. Can you do it? I said, fine. I was young. And I said, sure, I'll pitch. So I went out and he scored 25 runs for me. The Giants. See?
So,
yeah, and after the game's over, I beat him 25-3, I think. After the game's over, we're in the clubhouse taking a shower, and Bentley come up to me and slapped me on the back and said, I let you in on a cheap one, didn't I? I said, you sure did. So I went back to the hotel after the game's over, and here come a phone call from McGraw. He was up in the upstairs in his room. I want to see you. I went up. Jennings told me, he said, you pitched with 2 days rest, and you did a very good job. Now he said, what I want you to do, I want you to get your bag. I want you to get on the train and go back home. Go to New York. Spent 2 days. I wanted to see you in the ballpark for 2 days. I said, well. He always, not changing the subject, but always with McGraw on your pitching staff. If we played 4 games, generally on the road in each town. So the fourth game, if I was the first game, if I was going to open up on say we're in Cincinnati, and I was going to open up the first game in Pittsburgh, he would send me and the pitcher that pitched the day before on the train to Pittsburgh. Always send you ahead. Okay, you thought, riding on a train, it'd be best to get a day's rest. And
he always took care of his people, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was.
How about pitching in the polo grounds with those short walls? That's kind of tough.
Pitch so the balls, figured if you could be hit away, he's in center field, because your outfield was bunched, you see. Yeah. Your right fielder played over, your left fielder played over. So they were there. They run and catch those long balls in there, but you had right-handers could just pop a little. The scoreboard down on the right field line was nothing. It was tough.
Did you have any favorite parks to pitch in?
No, I didn't have any favorite. Pittsburgh, I guess. I beat them the last 15 games I pitched against them, I think. So I think they beat themselves more than anything. The way I worked it. Now, when I was with Brooklyn, I lived at the Alamac Hotel, and the Pittsburgh Ball Club stayed there. So I'd go down, and I'd see a bunch of them in the lobby. They're getting ready to take the subway to Brooklyn, see? So I'd wait till they went out the door, and I'd go out with them. And we'd get on the subway, and I'd get in the same car, generally, that they were in. And eventually, somebody's going to ask me, are you pitching today? And I'd say, yes, I am. Oh, I said, we might as well just give up. I said, we can't beat you. See, but I had them beat. The percentage was in my favor. They didn't believe it, so I just let them go with that. But I do that different times. I did that.
Well, do you have any tough hitters?
Huh?
Any toughest hitters stand out to pitch against?
Tough hitters? No. Oh, it's all of them that swung a bat. Yeah, well, Hornsby and Pie Trainer and the Wainers, and Jim Bonamy was a good hitter, and Chick Hafey was a real good hitter. And, I don't know, that was just... And Roush was a good hitter. I mean, you could go over the league and you could just, Hack Wilson and just a number of them that were real good hitters. You had to hit 265 or better to stay in the big leagues then. And if you didn't pitch 12 complete ball games or win 12 games, you didn't stay on the pitching staff. That was when they had a lot of these farm clubs, you see. Where they could send you out. Now it's not so. They own all of these farm clubs, you see. And they send a pitcher down for no reason at all, you see, now. But generally, when you went down, you didn't get back very quick, you see.
Well, you didn't go down, did you?
No, I never went down. I was always a starting pitcher.
George Kelly's your first baseman.
Yeah, George Kelly. He was there before Terry. Kelly went to Cincinnati.
He made the infielder's job a little easy with his height.
Gosh, what an arm. He made all the relays in the outfield. Oh. See, if an extra base hit was made, say in right center, he went to right center. Gosh. See, no use for him to be at first base because it was an extra base hit. So he went to right center and retrieved the ball. If the guy tried to score from first, tried to score, he had such a good arm, an accurate arm, he could throw him out. Now if the ball was hitting left center, he would, an extra base hit, he would go into back of second base out there and retrieve the ball and fire it. Oh yeah, he's
not many first basemen are used that way, are they?
No, not the way the arm he had. He had probably the best arm I ever saw.
Pretty good hitter too.
Oh yeah, he's till the latter part of his years. I mean, I think his eyes got a little hazy.
I think he's still over in California, up
San Francisco.
I hope to see him on our trip.
Yeah, he was working at the airport last I saw him. I don't know what he was doing, but.
How about fielding? Did McGraw make you pitchers work on your fielding?
Yeah, we had bunting games continuously. Have you been to any of these big games lately?
Well, I watch them on TV.
You don't see the preliminary ones. They get 8 or 10 pitchers in a row, and they have a bunter that bunts the ball.
Pepper game.
Yeah, the pepper game, see? So they catch it and throw it like this. And they throw it like a girl back to the hitter. And nothing. They might as well be standing up against the wall, you see. What we used to do was get 3 in a bunting game, get the hitter far enough back so he could hit line drives at you, see. Now, wherever the ball was, we tried to field it and throw it back to him as a hitter like we'd throw it to a first baseman, you see. And we learned to field, Schumacher and I. Of course, I guess was considered a good feeling for a pitcher. And I used to practically lead the league most every year in putouts and assists.
Right, Well, you had to be good.
Yeah. Well, I landed and I could go either way. Mm-hmm. And I never got off balance.
When you finish your motion, you're really set to move anyway.
Yeah, I made a little hop and I was set, see. Like balls hit back, I used to kick them.
Oh?
Stomp them. And knock them down. So they wouldn't go through the box if I couldn't get over.
You ever get hit by a ball, batted ball very hard?
Oh, yeah. I got knocked out twice in about 15 minutes.
Is that right?
Yeah. I got hit in the groin and knocked out. And I picked the ball up and I threw the first baseman. Got the man out with third out. I went in and the umpire came over and he said, "You all right?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I'm all right." He said, "Well, take your time. So I did, and I'm the first hitter. We're playing against Brooklyn. And the first pitch, the guy hit me right there. I didn't see it. Right there in the jaw with the fastball. Down I went again. Lopez was the catcher. And he took him about 2 or 3 minutes, he said, to catch me. I'd get up and I'd start again, and I'd go down and I'd get up and start again. So when I woke up, they said, "I guess you've had enough." I mean, Terry was a manager. Oh, yeah.
Van Lingo Mungo, pretty hard thrower, huh?
Oh, yeah. He had a good fastball. He was wild. He looked too wild. Yeah. And he was wild off the field, too.
Yeah, I guess he was. He did a lot of
that. That hurt him, yeah.
Yeah. How about Casey? Was Casey Stengel manager when you went to Brooklyn?
He went over to Boston, you know, managed Boston. I never played around him.
How about your single biggest thrill in baseball? Did anything stand out as a player?
Yeah, going to the big leagues, being sold to the Giants. Just the thought of being sold to a big league. And of course, that had to mean making good, too.
Yeah.
You're not just getting there, but you had to make good, see? So I made good, and I was a starting pitcher all the rest of it. And so I was very fortunate. I was in 6 World Series, 3 as a pitcher, 3 as a coach, and 2 All-Star games as a coach. So I had a pretty full life. 36 years in the major leagues.
Had a great career.
Yes, I did, and I couldn't, you know, I can't take any of that back.
Well, I think that's a fitting note to finish up on. I want to thank you very much for a fine interview.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. I'm going to...
first you should put on here about here, what happened.
Here we are in our little motel room the same night, June 16th, 1978. A night, a day we will not forget for a while. We're in Palm Springs, which is not very far from where we were last night. But it's quite a distance from where we thought we'd be tonight. About 4:15 and arrived about 10:45 in Beaumont and took a room in the Mountain View Motel. It was quite cool there because it was so much higher, a couple of thousand feet above sea level, compared to where we had been. It was a refreshing relief. But I went in and called up, first I called Leo DeRocher. We picked Beaumont because it was between three possible interviews. DeRocher in Palm Springs, Freddie Fitzsimmons in Yucca Valley, and Jack Rothrock in San Bernardino. As I prepared to make my calls, I found out that Rothrock had moved to Visalia, which meant that we had located much farther west than we needed to have located. Then I tried to call DeRocher and found out he had an unlisted number. Then I called Fitzsimmons and he wasn't in. And he wasn't likely to be in, but his wife was in and she didn't know much about anything. But she said maybe tomorrow morning, which would be today, after 10, they had something to do up till 10 o'clock. If we got there after 10, why, he might be able to see me for a while. Well, meanwhile, so we planned to do that, but in the afternoon we drove over to Palm Springs here from Beaumont, which is about 25 to 30 miles in the heat of the day. And Palm Springs is hot because it's at a much lower elevation. It's probably, well, today here it was well over 100 again, and it's probably in pretty mid-90s now, I suppose, outside, and it's 8:20 in the evening. So we drove over to Palm Springs to see DeRocher and finally found his house and his apartment in the Joshua Tree Apartments, 1400 East Palm Canyon Drive in Palm Springs. Apartment 210. And I went up there and there was a paper laying out in front of the apartment. Nobody answered the door, and I went down and spoke to an old gentleman lolling in the beautiful pool of this plush apartment complex. He said Leo was out of town on a speaking engagement, wouldn't be back on Saturday. So I left my message with him and we returned to Beaumont. Then this morning we got up, we had to take the car in to get the oil changed in Beaumont at the Ford dealer there. And we got it in there at 8 o'clock and asked him to check our transmission because it was giving us a little trouble yesterday. It was not shifting gears smoothly. We had to race sometimes to get up into the next gear range. So we had him look at that, and he said it'd take about an hour and a half. So we went and ate breakfast, and then came back about 9:30. Ate breakfast at a little restaurant, Carl's, not far from the Ford dealer. Then we got back about 9:30. The car was all ready to go. He changed the oil and lubricated it. Adjusted the linkage on the transmission, so that was in good shape. Drove around the block, so no problem there. Took $26 from us, and we were on our way to Yucca Valley, which is probably about a half hour to 40-minute drive east of Beaumont, along Route 10, back in the direction of Palm Springs. Then we take 62 north, about 20 miles, up a big mountain. And the old car was puffing and puffing going up that mountain. We got there about 10 after 10 in the morning, and or maybe around 10 in Yucca Valley, and stopped in at a gas station to try to find out where Tamarisk Place was, which is where Fitzsimmons lives. And he never heard of it, but he went in and had a map of Yucca Valley there, and he and his assistant were poring over. They finally located Tamarisk Place, and explained to me I had to go down Elk to Onega, over to Amador, down to Golden Desert Drive, and over to Koala, then to Carlisle, and then down to Tamarisk. And we made it all right without too much trouble in the the heat of the morning there, although it was high, elevation was high, it was still getting pretty warm. And we finally got to Fitzsimmons' house and was greeted by a couple of barking dogs. Practically every interview this trip has been marked by barking dogs. Well, he came out into the garage, and this is my first garage interview in history. The garage was just even with the main part of the house, and the doors were open. There's a motorcycle.
Attached garage.
Yeah, a motorcycle in there, and a lot of the usual garage arrangements, and all of his baseball pictures and mementos and things are in the garage, rather neatly mounted on walls and on tables around there, but it's not quite like having it all set up in an internal den. Now, so he was very nice. We set the recorder up on the bench there and began going, and it around 10:15 or 10:20 maybe. He said he had to go down to the doctor in Palm Springs sometime afternoon, shortly after noon, to get some shots, cortisone shots, I guess, or some kind of shots in his hand and shoulders. And so we would have, but he said sure he'd have an hour or so, and so we set it up, and it turned out to be a very good interview. Once he got warmed up, he just, as you can tell on the tape, he needed no real prompting. He had a little trouble picking the words he wanted to use at times to express himself, but he did a pretty good job, and he told some good stories. He didn't have too much of a sense of humor. I thought he might. Most pictures of him have him smiling and quite jovial, but he did have some good jokes, and he was very congenial during the interview. You want to describe the garage if you get through yawning?
Yeah, well, it was an attached garage,
and he
had his drive-in, and the top of the car almost didn't clear the garage door.
You mean the luggage rack filled with our tent?
Tent,
which
yeah.
Hasn't been used lately.
No, and as you're standing at the door of the garage, looking inward, on the far right-hand corner was the door into the house. And then he had five baseball gloves up on a wall. And then there was an old-fashioned sideboard with a mirror on it. And he had balls and trophies and things like that on it. And surrounding that, on the wall, were four black bats with names on them. And then he had pictures all over the wall. And in the just as you entered the garage, on the left, closest to the door, was an old, beat-up bookcase or shelf-like arrangement filled with envelopes that had all his baseball stuff on it and a bag that said Giants.
New York Giants.
New York Giants.
A nice canvas bag.
That was filled with autographed balls. And the balls he had out in the sideboard were his 200th game ball, an orange ball, the only time an orange ball was ever used.
In 1941, they experimented with it once. It was not a very good experiment.
It faded, and there was another ball there. What was that? Yeah, so those were there. And then his dogs, since he had this arrangement with two seats, I either had a choice of standing or sitting in the car. And since he had just, and he said I could have his chair. But since he just had a knee operation, I didn't think that was a very polite thing to do. So I thought, well, I will trot around and see what I can see. And on the porch, they had those white metal scrolly chairs, Mediterranean type patio things. And I thought I'd go up there with my book and read. And I went up there and sat down and nearly jumped out of my skin when I heard this ferocious bark right behind me. And I got up and I turned around and I was staring into the eyes of a Great Dane.
Great Dane in the morning.
Who was inside the house, fortunately. And it seems he has four of them. Two big ones and two puppies. And even he said he was afraid to have us in the house, whether that was just an excuse or not. Because I thought, boy, she must be some kind of madam. Wasn't she the one that said they had just moved in there and she didn't know how to...
All their stuff was in storage or so.
And...
When I mentioned yesterday on the phone about scrapbooks and pictures, she had said that they had just moved in and the stuff was not out available.
Well, if they had just moved in, they were pretty well... I figured she just wouldn't have half that stuff in her house. That's what I figured. And that's why it was all out there.
We never met her, by the way. She never appeared at all. She was in with the Great Danes.
And a lady friend came and called on her and went in and talked to her.
What did the Danes do about that?
I don't know, but she was in the house most of the time you were there. And the motorcycle belonged to his grandson.
Yeah, I didn't think he drove that.
Unless his grandson lives with him. I don't know. I couldn't quite figure that out either. But he said they had moved up there because they had lived in Arcadia. And if they had lived in Arcadia, he would have been dead. So they moved up there.
Because of?
The smog. And they moved up there where the air was pure and the water was pure. And he felt like a new man. I think that's my comment on it.
Very good comment. That was a big dog, huh? Can you describe the dog?
Oh, just a big Great Dane, but it was the size. He was a big Great Dane.
We were speculating as to why they had so many dogs, and we thought probably security, but I would think that's a pretty secure place up there.
I don't know, but I think you'd only need one of those, because I'm sure that he stood the top of his head was a good 4 feet high, if not higher. As I say, I felt like I was staring him in the face. And so I took a chair and moved it over into the garage.
Very good.
And then I moved it back. And the interview was over.
Well, we chatted on about... one side of the tape ran out, and we were still going strong, so I asked him if he wouldn't mind doing a little bit more, so I flipped it over, and just at the time of the, what story was he telling about somebody?
Kyler.
Yeah, Kyler, when he decked him. And that didn't, he told that, but the tape had already run out. It was one of those days the switch didn't snap off on the recorder, and I had to keep an eye to make sure I wasn't running over, and I did run over a little bit, so he repeated that story. And ran on for about another 20 minutes or so, and those kids out in the street, what were they doing? They're making that clang, clang?
They lived next door to them. There were four of them. I don't know if they were all in the one family. And they were playing, and they were climbing up the hills and that, and then their mother brought them a treat. Whatever it was, Misty or something, I thought she said. And then pretty soon, out came this band, these instruments, and that was a cymbal. This little boy had two cymbals that he was clanging together that you heard. And another one had drumsticks.
That shortened the interview, that racket in the background. I knew we couldn't go on much longer with that, but it was running out. I'm glad they didn't come any earlier.
And, well, they had been playing around there, but that was the first time they had gotten that noisy. Because I'm sure the dog barking will be on the tape. And there was another dog was barking farther along. Then the kids came up near the house, and the dogs started to bark.
But nothing as distracting as that racket with the cymbals, though. So it was about 11:45, I guess, when we shut the recorder off. And I was taking some pictures with the 35mm camera, but they were against the back wall of the garage, and the light was reflecting in through the door, and they glare off the picture, so I couldn't do much of that. Then he dug up some pictures from one of those packages in the bookcase there. I took a few of those, then I ran out of film. I thought I had a 36 exposure packet, but it turned out to be 20, and I only got about 3 or 4 pictures. There's a nice one he had of himself, which somebody spilled coffee all over, not on his face, but I took a picture of that with the regular instant camera, so maybe that'll come out. So there wasn't much in the way of pictures. He gave me one picture of himself, a kind of a head and shoulder shot, 8x10, when he managed the Phillies, which was not what I wanted. I wanted an action shot earlier in his prime, but I couldn't quibble about that. He did autograph it.
You have to take what you can get.
He autographed the ball.
Rita took a couple, I took a picture of him holding his 200th victory ball, and she took a picture of us just standing aimlessly there in the back of the garage.
Yeah, I hope the flash didn't go off in the mirror of that thing. That's what I wondered about.
Which picture is that? The one of us?
Yeah, didn't you use a flash on him too?
Yeah. In what mirror?
The mirror in that sideboard.
Well, we can't worry about that now. Then, well, we left there about 12:15, and then the fun began. I thought it was a good interview. Feeling pretty good when we were coming down there. We went into town and stopped and got organized and started driving back. We were going to go to, the plan was to go up to around Bakersfield today, get a start on the northern route, and maybe camp or get our motel or something there. But we weren't going to battle Los Angeles. We decided against that. There'd be some good interviews there, but just the traffic and the trying to get a place to stay and trying to arrange these interviews, which is very hard work. And it's a good deal of driving to and to obscure places. So it just wasn't worth it. But then coming back down that hill from Yucca Valley, the car just wasn't working right. It wouldn't shift into high gear at all. I had trouble shifting into second gear sometimes. So I just had to kind of take it about 45 miles an hour without racing it too much all the way down. We thought we'd go to Banning, but then we decided to go to try Palm Springs because it's closer. It's a bigger town, and since it's such a resort town, we figured they would surely have a Ford agency there. So we kind of limped into Palm Springs, and hot. It was about 110 already by 1 o'clock. So we got there, and we didn't have the air conditioner on because of all the stops in the streets there. And I stopped and asked the Texaco man where if they had the Ford agency. He said, yes, about 5.5 miles down the road. It turned out to be a couple miles right beyond where Leo DeRocher lives. And of course, I said before when I was there yesterday, I couldn't get back in time to see him, but that may be altered now, as you'll find out. Well, we found the Ford agency and took it in, and he was booked all kinds of jobs up through Tuesday or so. He had a table full of orders. And I told him the problem, and one of his lieutenants looked under the hood, and the smoke poured out of something, and he shut the hood down again. And he wanted to drive it himself, so he drove around the block or so. And on the way back, he says, it's got to come out. Got to come out. Says it was jumping from first to third, was just missing. And while it could be driven locally in short distances, and maybe even on the road, it wouldn't matter much, but a lot of driving was be not suitable for it. What could we do? It was 1:30 by now. They were booked up through Monday or Tuesday. Of course, everything like this happens on a Friday when they can't get in, and they're closed Saturday and Sunday. So we called up to Indio, about 30 miles away. He's booked up till Wednesday. We thought of going back to Banning, but that guy is the one who said it was all right this morning when he checked the linkage. So we didn't know if he would know what to do about it. Maybe just didn't want to bother with it. So we fiddled around and finally decided to just stay here, get a motel, make the best of it for the weekend and beyond, and take the thing in on Monday. He said bring it in early Monday. Maybe they can get at it then. It'll be an all-day job, covered by our warranty, naturally, because we haven't gone 12,000 miles yet, and just to make ourselves comfortable.
So the chap was very nice.
Yeah, their service manager there, or the assistant service manager, I guess he was, he called up this hotel, this Beckley Motel, which he thought would be reasonably priced and not too far from the agency's shop there. And they did have a vacancy, and so I talked to the lady, and we came on down here. Got here about 2 o'clock or so and checked in. And have a nice room with
refrigerator. The air conditioner's out in the adjoining room. It doesn't get in here very much. It's kind of hot in the living room here, where the sleeping quarters and TV and everything else is. But it's still cooler than it is outside, as we find every time we go out to bring something into the car. And there are many of those times. So our plan is to just stay here. And maybe I can get the Leo DeRocher interview in now, since he'll be back tomorrow. I may go over there tomorrow and either see him or leave a message for me to reach him Sunday.
I leave a message.
Or later Saturday. Yeah. And then on Monday we'll take the car in, and I suppose come back here and just sit around.
They said they'd drive you back.
Yeah. And it's pretty good here. We've got plenty of supplies. TV, the baseball game is just on. It's over, and there'll be a couple tomorrow, and one Sunday and one Monday. So there'll be baseball every day to watch here. And there'll be books to read and catching up to do generally. So it was quite a blow to hear this, but we expected, I guess, something would happen on this trip. We didn't know what it would be. And I don't think we thought that would be it.
But, could have happened in a worse place.
Yeah, we're thinking what would happen if that began to act up in the heat of the desert, which we crossed over yesterday, 300 miles. And we were below sea level, too, some places. But actually, the drive was rather smooth, and the car behaved until we got here, where at least we have a place now and can get it fixed.
I was thinking, here Indio is all filled up. Here, Palm Springs, the Ford dealer, is so busy he doesn't know what to do. And up at Banning, they didn't have anything.
And we think we know why now.
That's right.
He doesn't know anything. I wanted to really change the oil. It's worth just $26.
We might mention that to them.
Yeah.
We have them.
So it was quite a blow, and we're going to lose 3 or 4 days here. We might pick up an interview and maybe get caught up in our reading. Nice pool outside. Maybe I can get a swimming suit and cool off in the pool, but I doubt there's any place to get one.
But we are not upset. We are taking it all in our stride.
We've begun our 5th week of this vacation in quite a stylish way.
Yep. Even if we're frustrated, we're...
Any thought of going to L.A. now was certainly killed by this development. We just wouldn't have the time. We have, I think, a very deep-seated feeling to get out of Southern California as fast as we can.
And you're right.
Once we can.
You're right.
It's hot here, but it's not up in Banning. It's much about 10 to 15 degrees cooler there. It's quite interesting how that elevation makes that much difference. L.A. itself, I guess, is never nearly as hot as it is here. I've heard in the news many times the hottest place in the country has been Palm Springs, California, or Phoenix, Arizona. Those two places seem to take the cake, and you can see why it is now. This is a real plush community, fabulous apartment, a living apartment with facilities, with pools and all their...
spas and jacuzzis and
the streets of the town are lined with, it's like Fifth Avenue. There's Saks Fifth Avenue is there. We saw one for broker's offices, all the some broker offices. So it's catering to the elite without a question, to retire to this area or else spending some months here.
There's an Alan Ladd building and a Frank Sinatra Boulevard and a Bob Hope
Gene
Boulevard.
Gene Autry Motel.
It charges $80 a day.
A lot of these places close up in the next month or so because people
July.
Won't stay here in this hot weather.
July.
I guess it gets even hotter in July. It must be pretty hot. Or just filling time here. This tape ought to run out by now. I can't understand why it keeps on going.
But it is.
Let's see how much there is left. There's not very much left, so we might as well use it up and tell jokes.
What kind of jokes?
Well, good jokes. How about some Polish jokes?
Oh no. Well,
we went to breakfast this morning at Carl's in Banning. It's kind of a cafeteria, where you order something, they bring it to you, and a rather bouncy blonde young lady waited on us, and she cashed the traveler's check and said, West Virginia. Where are you from in West Virginia? We said, Parkersburg. I'm from Charleston. How'd you get to Charleston? Well, we left when I was 13, which must have been about 4 or 5 years ago. She isn't that old. Maybe she's in her early 20s. I went to Florida, and then from Florida they came out here. She was a good one, though. And then they had a crisis, though, at Carl's. Somebody didn't show up, and somebody else showed up late. I know when the manager came in, this blonde said to her, are you in a good mood today? He said, yes. Well, I said, we're short-handed. It was a good breakfast there. We enjoyed it. We went back to pick up our car. Things seemed to be working fine on our way to a good interview and then off to Bakersfield. Things seemed pretty good then.
Yep.
All during the interview, though, I began to think, because the car had acted up a little bit on the way up, in the back of my mind, is this thing going to be a problem on the way out of here? And the answer was yes, it was a problem. And since you can't think of any more jokes, and we want to watch Wonder Woman, it's almost over now, but we can watch the last few minutes. We can turn Wonder Woman back up just in time to see her heroics. So, that's about it. I wish this tape would end.
And it just keeps on going.
End. I'll give this tape 10 seconds to end. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 and a half, 8, 8 and a quarter, 8 and a half, 8 and 3 quarters, 9, 9 and an eighth, 9 and a quarter, 9 and 3/8, 9 and 7/16, 9 and a half, 9 and 9/16, 9 and 5/8.
You're gone.
9 and what's next? 9 and 11/16, 9 and 3/4. 9 and 13/16, 9 and 7/8, 9 and 15/16.
He's not going to do it for you, Father. That is for sure.